From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is expected to announce this hour that he'll refuse to recertify the Iran nuclear deal, kicking the decision on whether or not to continue suspending sanctions on the country to Congress. Iran agreed to freeze its nuclear program in 2015 in return for a partial lifting of sanctions. The White House said today's decision is part of a new, tougher strategy on Iran. The BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, joins us from London. And Lise, what's at stake here?
A lot is at stake here. To put it at its broadest, it is the word of the United States when it comes to respecting international agreements. And in this case, not just an international agreement, but what is widely regarded as a triumph of diplomacy, the most important non-proliferation agreement of the past quarter century, negotiated among world powers. If Washington in the next few months ends up breaking its word by destroying this deal, Washington's word will certainly be tarnished. Secondly, there is the impact of the deal itself. There still is a number of hurdles that still have to pass. What will Congress do? Will it continue to waive the sanctions? Will it impose them? Will it introduce new sanctions? What will the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese, all of whom have said the nuclear deal is working, what can and will they do to try to keep the deal on track? There have, after all, been 8 reports of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which said Iran has complied. And then lastly, what about Iran? The Iranian negotiators negotiated hard for this deal. They knew and they continue to say there were many among what are known as the hardliners in Iran who said this won't work. You cannot trust the United States. And that goes all the way up to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. They will have many saying to them, "We told you so." And the worry is that the hardliners will be empowered against the so-called reformists.
Has there been any reaction so far in Europe and among the other countries that are part of this nuclear deal?
A lot of reaction, both in public and in private. I spoke to Federica Mogherini, Europe's foreign policy chief, at the United Nations last month. She said, "Why would anyone want to tear up this deal? The deal is working." And when you are also confronting a threat from the nuclear power of North Korea, where there are no negotiations now, why would you add another problem? Emmanuel Macron, the French president, said it would be a grave error to undermine this deal. So the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese have been absolutely categorical. The deal is working. Something else when it comes to Iran's ballistic missile program, its behavior across the region, but those are separate issues. Their view is, we've got the deal. It deals with one of the issues as it was meant to do. It wasn't meant to deal with ballistic missiles and other aspects of the relationship between Iran and world powers. But let's deal with the other issues in another way.
Well, the other issues include President Trump's claim that Iran is violating the spirit of the deal by supporting terrorism in the region. What is the truth to that?
Well, that is a big question. Iran is on the terrorism list for its ballistic missile program, for being linked to the Hezbollah movement in Lebanon, which is regarded as a terrorist organization by the United States and by the United Kingdom and other countries, although it is a member of the Lebanese parliament. So Iran is accused of sponsoring terrorist groups, of promoting extremism. Iran, of course, disputes that. If you speak to Iranians, as I have over the senior Iranians over the past few weeks regarding this issue, they will say that their presence in Syria, their presence in Iraq has been at the invitation of the government. And in both cases, they're right. President Assad is working with the Iranians, one of his key allies. Prime Minister Abadi in Iraq is depending on the largely Shia militias, some of them sponsored, trained, organized by Iran to fight against so-called Islamic State. The Americans, we know, is also involved in that fight, but not fighting alongside the militias. So for the Iranians, it's a question of definition. These are the issues which have to be dealt with. And in the view of the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese, by and large, is that by imposing sanctions, by being aggressive, you are going to move Iran in a direction that you do not want them to move. Among senior Iranians, the view is that the imposition of a host of new sanctions, including against the main security body in Iran, is tantamount to a declaration of war.
I am sure that in the next month or two, we are going to hear President Trump say that this deal is a bad deal and needs to be renegotiated. Do you see any way that Iran would be willing to renegotiate this deal and the other countries?
There is no sign of that. President Rouhani, at the United Nations last month, I went to his press conference. It was categorical. There is no return to the deal. There is no reopening of the deal. There is no renegotiation of the deal. And if you want to push Iran to renegotiate, well, as the foreign minister of Iran, Javad Zarif, put it, sure, negotiations mean give and take. And there were things that we didn't like, including having to ship out 10 tons of enriched uranium out of the country. Please send that nuclear fuel back, because we don't like some parts of the deal either.
That's the BBC's Lise Doucette joining us from London. Lise, thank you so much as always.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Well, California officials say this is the deadliest week of wildfires in that state's history. Parts of Northern California scorched, entire neighborhoods gone. The greatest damage in Sonoma County, north of San Francisco, 400 people still reported missing, although many could just be displaced and without their cell phones. Ted Goldberg is covering the fires for KQED in San Francisco. And Ted, the bad news here, as if we could need more, is that the winds that whipped these fires are coming back.
Yeah, that's true. Right now, and I just spoke to a CAL FIRE representative, they are hoping that they can gain some ground throughout the day today. And that's because the winds for the first part of the day are not expected to be as strong as they are going to be tonight and then tomorrow. So actually, we did get a slight amount of good news this morning. Two of the very massive, the large fires that are burning in the North Bay, this is in Sonoma and Napa and Solano counties, firefighters were able to get actually some significant containment on two of them, the Tubbs and Atlas fires. You know, we had been reporting for days 0% contained, 3% contained. This morning, both of those fires are at least 25% contained. Mm. But you're right, the news is for the most part very bad. There are 31 people who have died in these fires. Yesterday, the mayor of Santa Rosa in Sonoma County announced that close to 3,000 homes have been destroyed.
Right. And are there new mandatory evacuation orders?
You know what? There are not many new mandatory evacuation orders. Every now and then, authorities in Sonoma and Napa counties will announce some advisory evacuations, which pretty much just means, you know, you can go if you want. You should be ready to go at a moment's notice. There was an actual mandatory evacuation in Napa County that was lifted in a couple of different neighborhoods. But, you know, for the most part, many people are, you know, have been outside of their homes for, you know, since Sunday night when these fires began. They don't know if their homes have been destroyed, and that's been a big, frustrating waiting game that they've had to play since then.
Well, not only not knowing if their homes are destroyed, but not knowing even if they can get back to their homes, when they can go in them. I mean, gas is turned off. I mean, what's the sense of what happens if they can go back?
Well, we sent a reporter to an intersection in the North Bay where, you know, sort of authorities had put up a barrier and said, you know, when and if you are allowed back in, this is where you'll be allowed to go through. But, you know, they were just waiting there and hoping to go back inside to their neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And the frustration was just so great.
Well, and the terrible stories that are surfacing. In Santa Rosa, a vacationing couple in their 70s fled into a pool, but they were then burned by embers and choked by smoke. The wife dying in her husband's arms. Another couple stayed in a freezing neighbor's pool, you know, for 6 hours, freezing water. Also battled falling, burning debris and smoke. They survived. I mean, you know, what kinds of things are surfacing?
Well, you know, right now, I think what's surfacing is that we are going to be waiting a long time before we find out the end of this story. Mm-hmm. I think right now we're in the midst of something. You know, a lot of times when disasters happen, you know, they take place and then, you know, for the next few days, we describe that in the news business as the aftermath. And I really believe that we are actually, it's happening still right now. These fires, you know, I mentioned that there was some containment on them, but they are not out and they are still threatening communities. And there are still large neighborhoods where authorities have not been able to go yet and to inspect homes. And it's believed that some of those unaccounted for, you know, could have died in those homes. And we may not know, you know, the numbers for a very long time. So I think this is just the beginning of what's become a very, you know, sad story.
Yeah. Well, and just to less the air quality, it's been compared to Beijing, emergency rooms crowded, schools closed, and there might be small fibers that can embed in people's lungs.
I mean, the way things look in San Francisco, where our station is located, for the last few days, you know, the sky has been white, the sun has been orange. Our bus drivers are wearing masks around their faces. You can see people on bicycles with those white masks as well. You know, yesterday they announced that San Francisco State University was canceling classes today. In San Francisco, this is an hour away from where these fires are. We've been in touch with SFO, San Francisco International Airport. In the last 3 days, 300 flights have been canceled because of the smoke problems. Mm-hmm. I have never experienced smoke this week ever. Like it's been here. It's been a very frustrating thing. We actually have been smelling it inside buildings for several days.
The Oakland Raiders practicing with masks on. Ted Goldberg of KQED in San Francisco has this terrible story of the fires, as he said, an hour away, continues. Ted, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This morning at the Values Voter Summit, a gathering of religious conservatives, President Trump played to his base.
The American founders invoked our Creator four times in the Declaration of Independence. Four times. How times have changed, but you know what? Now they're changing back again. Just remember that.
Well, meanwhile, for the second week in a row, a member of Trump's inner circle stepped before reporters to say he's not quitting or being fired. Lots to talk about in our Friday roundtable. Joining us today, Jesse Holland of the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
Doing well. And Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News and MSNBC. Hi, Beth.
Hello.
And Beth, let me start with you. On the issue of health care, yesterday President Trump signed an executive order opening the door for cheaper, less regulated group plans. And late last night, he decided to end the subsidies that help people pay for coverage under the Affordable Care Act. This morning, he said this.
One by one, it's going to come down and we're going to have great health care in our country. We are going to have great health care in our country. We're taking a little different route than we had hoped. Because getting Congress, they forgot what their pledges were. So we're going a little different route. But you know what? In the end, it's going to be just as effective, and maybe it'll even be better.
Beth, is he just trying to sabotage Obamacare, and aren't a lot of people going to suffer because of it?
Well, that's just it. This war that he's waged against Obamacare from the beginning isn't just about politics. It's actually about people and people's health care and people's coverage. He has been very intent on dismantling President Obama's legacy in many areas, but his focus on Obamacare has been the primary goal of his through the campaign and until now. So he's found a way to snip away at the law because it was not overturned by Congress, as he noted there in that soundbite that you just played. But guess what? This could cause massive disruption in the marketplace, and he will own this. He no longer can call this Obamacare if he is going to take these kind of steps to change the law, to change people's coverage. Republicans own this. President Trump is going to own the outcome of this, and we have yet to see what that's going to look like. But it's not going to be good. People are very, very concerned about their health care under any circumstances and changes to their insurance. So if this creates a massive disruption in the marketplace, it's going to fall to President Trump to answer for it.
Well, Jesse Holland, let's explain. Because the banners on CNN and in all the headlines, it says, you know, President Trump ending subsidies to poor people. He's not. By law, under Obamacare, those subsidies, you know, have to go to, you know, the insurance companies have to help cover the poorer people. He's ending the subsidies to the insurance companies. They're going to have to get that money somewhere else, and they're going to probably get it from a lot of Trump supporters.
Right. Well, the thing that is going to affect people here is going to be their premiums. What we're going to see from this, unless Congress immediately steps in and does something, which honestly is unlikely, what we're going to see is people will be paying more for their health insurance.
Right. And not poor. I want to make that clear. The poorer people still have to get these subsidies. That's the law. He's not changing the law, which is, you know, Obamacare. They will still get their subsidies, but those insurance companies are going to lose $7 billion.
And if we know corporations the way we do, they're going to find a way to make up that money. Right. And usually what happens is they raise prices on consumers. So we don't really – this is putting us into uncharted territory. We have no idea what's going to happen yet. And this has been done without any study or without any congressional hearings. This is something the president's doing on his own. If things go sideways, we now have Trump care instead of Obamacare. And the Republicans – and the president are going to have to own it. Now, the president said that he thinks that this is going to make Democrats come to him
right.
and renegotiate Obamacare. Well, they might just sit back and say, hey, this is Trump care. This is what you voted for. Let's see how it works.
Well, speaking of President Trump trying to get Democrats to come and talk with him, what about DACA, Beth? I mean, he thinks that Democrats are going to come back and start to change the terms of that deal that he made with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. Is that going to happen, or what do you expect to happen with DACA?
Well, it's a very strange sort of political chess game that's going on here around DACA because, as you guys know, Democrats are in no hurry to cooperate with President Trump on almost anything. On the other hand, those lawmakers who have significant numbers of DACA recipients in their districts don't want those folks to face deportation. So they really do – they're under political pressure to figure out some sort of solution so that those folks are not going to be endangered. However, President Trump is also playing a strange game of political chess here too. Because one of his signature promises during the campaign was to really crack down on illegal immigration. That's a very important issue to his base. Now he seems to be wobbling on that. On the one hand, he said he had made a deal with Chuck and Nancy, as he was referring to the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, the senior Democrat in the House, to protect the DACA recipients. Then last week, his administration released a list of conditions to protect the DACA recipients that included things like building the wall, which Democrats are never going to agree to. So it's hard to see what President Trump is trying to do here. He's expressing all sorts of concern and compassion for the DACA recipients, but he's also wavered back and forth about what kind of negotiation or what kind of deal he's willing to do in order to protect them. And it's absolutely clear that Democrats will not support anything that involves building the wall. So that puts pressure on them too, because if they are not going to play ball with President Trump, if those are his terms, those DACA recipients in their districts will be in trouble.
Well, you say it's hard to see what President Trump is trying to do. As we all know and listeners know, there's been a lot of reporting this week, a lot of it anonymously sourced, that what he's trying to do is flail out, and he's angry, and he's angry at everybody in the White House, and there's divisions and there's chaos. Yesterday, Chief of Staff John Kelly, who we all remember was brought in to, it was said, keep the president from tweeting and to keep some calm, and there's been all sorts of reporting that he's had it, and his relationship with Trump has deteriorated. He made a remarkable appearance yesterday and spoke about that.
Although I read it all the time, pretty consistently, I'm not quitting today. I don't believe, and I just talked to the president, I don't think I'm being fired today. I am not so frustrated in this job that I'm thinking of leaving. I would tell you.
Jesse, your comments on that.
Well, the key words in that statement from John Kelly is the words today. I'm not being fired today. I'm not going to quit today. That leaves the rest of the year wide open.
Well, I mean, he might say, "Oh, you're searching. I came out and made this remarkable statement."
Well, I mean, just the fact that you have to make that statement makes, especially here in Washington, throws another light on it all, on everything. The fact that the chief of staff has to come out and say, no, 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 guys, I'm really not being fired. No, 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 I'm really not leaving. What does that say about the state of the White House itself? It's one of those incredible moments that you see where someone has to say, oh, by the way, I'm really not being fired. That just shows the incredible chess game, the incredible Game of Thrones environment inside the White House where people have to assure the public that, no, I'm still going to be here. That's just incredible just by itself.
Well, and it just shows, Beth, the chaos that is clearly going on in the White House, as much as they'll deny it. To have this happen every week and a Secretary of Health and Human Services leave, and then the next week we've got the Secretary of State coming out and saying, I'm not quitting, and John – I mean, it's just – doesn't it appear to be chaos?
Well, General Kelly was a very effective spokesman, I thought, yesterday for President Trump. He comes off as such a sort of steadying presence. He seemed very smart. He seemed very calm. He placed a whole sort of new blanket onto the Trump White House and all of those stories of chaos. So they would probably be very smart to have him go out and talk to the press often, because he did convey a greater sense of calm than we believe to be going on under
that
the
surface.
That is
something that they said about Anthony Scaramucci, I think, that he – what a great voice for the White House, and he lasted something like 10 days, right?
Well, he really was a disrupting influence inside the White House. General Kelly is not, but, you know, General Kelly is under a lot of stress in this job. There's a concern, widespread concern, that if people like General Kelly or Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, were to leave, who would want to replace them in those jobs? So there's some pressure for them to stay around, to keep that sense of stability that the two of them are trying to convey. But there's a lot of pressure on everybody within this White House and within this administration. The president is very hard to work with. He's erratic, as we can see.
Well, I'm going to jump in to say that one of these articles we're talking about is the one in Vanity Fair, where reporter Gabriel Sherman says he spoke with prominent Republican and Trump advisors who say the president is unraveling. Now, his former chief strategist, Steve Bannon, also even warned the president about the 25th Amendment and, you know, the fact that the cabinet, there might be a coup to remove him. Isn't that, though, Jesse, your thoughts, is that partly to gin up the base, to, you know, to even put that thought out there?
Well, Trump is at his best when he has an enemy to fight against. So this helps him by saying it's us against them. It's me against the cabinet. It's me against the Democrats. It's me against the liberal media. It's me against somebody. Trump is at his best when he has an enemy. So they seem to keep finding enemies for him to fight against, whether it's the NFL, whether it's the Democrats, whether it's Republicans, whether it's Bob Corker. He is at his best when he has someone to fight against. So they keep finding someone to fight against.
Yeah.
And so he just keeps on going.
Well, and at his best, maybe it's not the way that everyone sees how he is when he's got an enemy to fight against. But Jesse Holland with the Associated Press and Beth Fooey with NBC News and MSNBC, thank you. Quite a week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Here in Boston, fans expect a lot. A lot from their teams, and a lot from the reporters who cover them. I'm Boston Globe sports columnist Chris Gasper. I'm working with WBUR to bring you a new daily podcast, Season Ticket. I'll take fans with me for a behind-the-scenes look, from the press box to the locker room and beyond. Season Ticket, available at WBUR.org/seasonticket or wherever you get your podcasts. Funding provided by Zip, the smartest way to hire.
Back to our top story now. In a few minutes, President Trump is expected to announce that he will not recertify the Iran nuclear deal. Congress will now have 60 days to decide whether to reimpose sanctions on Iran, sanctions that were lifted when Iran agreed to halt its nuclear program in 2015. Joining us now is foreign affairs analyst Jonathan Wachtel, who's the former director of communications at the U.S. mission to the U.N. and former spokesman to Nikki Haley. Jonathan Wachtel, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. Nice to be here.
And Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Defense Secretary James Mattis have both said Iran is complying with the terms of the agreement, but you still think the president is right to decertify the deal. Explain that.
Look, the deal's a bad deal. So it's the same deal that was struck a couple of years ago. We have a problem in which there is a deal in which certain sites, specifically military sites in Iran, are off limits to IAEA inspectors. Iran has been an absolutely bad actor since clinching the deal. Look, there's an argument that this is all about nonproliferation, which is true. That's what the deal was aimed at doing. But for instance, leaving the ballistic missile tests out, and we've all seen that there are a lot of ballistic missile tests coming out of North Korea, and we all know that there is a nuclear component to those ballistic missiles. So everything ties into the nonproliferation issue. So it's important that we're scrutinizing things again.
So you don't think that a flawed deal is better than no deal at all if it keeps Iran from having a nuclear weapon?
First of all, we don't know that this is keeping Iran from having a nuclear weapon. What is beneficial, of course, and you know, no one is going to argue against this, is that there is some inspection going on of Iran. That's helpful. Of course it's helpful. But we don't know whether it's enough to contain the matter. In fact, there are arguments coming out of various corners saying that indeed it's not, that Iran's program is intact, that there are at least six military sites that are still continuing with the weaponization aspects of the nuclear program. So it's really uncertain where we are.
What about the signal that it sends for the U.S. to back out of an international agreement to North Korea? A lot of experts are saying it's going to make it much harder for the U.S. to negotiate with North Korea because they'll say the U.S. can't be trusted to keep up its end of an agreement.
Well, there are two things to talk about. Number one is you don't just stay with a situation if it's a flawed situation and dangerous to your country. So staying in there just for the sake of staying in there is kind of a ridiculous argument. Secondly, the deal that was struck was not the right deal. So the signal also could be interpreted as saying, hey, North Korea, we need to do a proper deal this time. So you can't fudge along things and, for instance, not give IAEA inspectors access to military sites, because military sites are, of course, going to be a place in which you're going to have some sort of activities that have a military component to whatever you're working on. So this could be an opportunity to signal to North Korea, you know what, we're willing to do deals, but we got to do a deal that makes sense.
So Congress now has to decide whether to reimpose sanctions. What do you think they should do?
Congress needs to take this opportunity to get things right. Here's a chance to really lay out the groundwork to try to augment the deal. Let's try to work things out so we can figure out what we're getting into here and not end up in a situation in which Iran is ready to spring right into action and we were idiots with the wool pulled over our eyes and just blind to what was going on.
That's Jonathan Wachtel, who is the former director of communications at the U.S. mission to the U.N. and spokesman to Nikki Haley. Thank you so much for joining us.
A real pleasure, Jeremy.
Nearly 2 weeks after the shooting in Las Vegas that left 58 dead and around 500 injured, investigators still don't know why the shooter fired on a crowd or why he stopped or even what the exact timeline was. But planners of events and concerts around the country aren't waiting for answers. They're taking precautions. Joining us now is Chris Robinette, who's the president of Prevent Advisors, which specializes in security for events and concerts. And Chris, when you look at what happened in Las Vegas, do you see a way more or better security could have prevented it?
Well, it's important, I think, to start with the fact that there's no manual or playbook for this type of thing, particularly as it relates to this event. You know, it's important to look at every individual environment, every individual venue or ecosystem, and make a critical analysis of what risks manifest themselves, what occur more typically, what occur episodically, and what are or maybe even potentially black swan type events.
Black swan type events means an event that would be totally unexpected.
Right. You plan for the worst in that sense. And then you make the prioritization of resources and look at what you can do to offset those risks. That's going to include, you know, concert security as far as what's available to promoters or event planners, and then the local law enforcement community as well.
So it sounds like you're saying not necessarily something that you could do to prevent an attack like what we just saw in Vegas.
This event in particular would be very, very difficult to prevent or deter just because of the unique nature of it. It's got a hotel or an entertainment facility situated across a divided highway from where the concert actually took place. So there's a lot of stakeholders and there's a lot of things that would have had to been in collaboration to really prevent or deter this type of event.
I went to a concert the other day at a pretty big venue, and I noticed as I was coming out a couple of police cars stationed right outside, and there was a car that was blocking off the street that people would have to walk down to get to the venue. And I wondered, is that something that is new, or is that something that would have been happening even before Las Vegas?
There's always been a high degree of collaboration between event planners, security directors, facility managers, and law enforcement. What we see is the nature of the threat is evolving and changing. In Manchester, we've always got an explosive device outside of the building, right, which is beyond where you normally screen, where the magnetometers are looking for threats. You know, what you've had in Boston is an open air event where, you know, someone detonated the device just generally in the public at large, or what otherwise would be the public at large. And then here you've got an active shooter that was very offset or exterior to the venue. You know, now there's just a heightened sense of concern and security, and no one's leaving anything to chance in terms of certainly what they can plan for or what they can foresee in those environments.
And is there anything that you can do if the shooter or the attacker is outside of the perimeter, the security perimeter?
You know, I hesitate to say that there's nothing you can do because that's never true. You know, I think what this has taught us is, you know, in terms of preparedness, it's important to have discussions now with security managers or facility directors in the buildings that may be adjacent to where these outdoor events are occurring.
One issue is that when people have to go through metal detectors and other barriers and when they see armed police and security guards, it might give them a greater sense of security, but it can also make people feel anxious and feel less safe. Do we risk something by having too much security for big, fun events where you're supposed to enjoy yourself?
Right. At the end of the day, I think nobody wants to give up sort of the mentality of these things are enriching in our lives, music, sporting events. And so, you know, we tell people all the time, we're here to protect and preserve those events. And we never want to distract or take away from the enjoyability of those things. But there is a degree of security that can present as a deterrence to bad actors as a whole. And so it's important to incorporate that balance of how much is too much and how much is not enough. That comes from a thoughtful analysis of what risks may or may not present themselves in certain environments. And that comes from a conversation that takes place with event promoters, facility managers, local law enforcement, first responders, and even kind of the community as a whole, right? Because we now have an environment where see something, say something is ever more important as it relates to understanding how to identify threats.
That's Chris Robinette, who is president of Prevent Advisors, which specializes in security for events and concerts. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us on.
Well, there are a couple of TV shows that debuted new seasons this week, including Mr. Robot.
What I'm about to tell you is top secret. A conspiracy bigger than all of us. There's a powerful group of people out there that are secretly running the world. I'm talking about the guys no one knows about, the guys that are invisible. The top 1% of the top 1%, the guys that play God without permission.
That's Elliot Alderson, the hacker hero of USA's award-winning drama. Mr. Robot returned Wednesday for a third season. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us with more. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
And tell us more, first of all, for people who haven't seen this show, about Elliot, who's the character at the center of the show.
Yeah, played by Rami Malek. Well, this is one of the most interesting characters on television. He suffers from a mental illness, and we found out, I guess at the end of the first season, that he's actually two people, back and forth between his own persona as a 20-something hacker with incredible abilities and this other persona that is in the image of his dead father that wants to implement this plan to hack the nation's economy. Now, they pull it off, and as the third season opens, you know, Elliot realizes that he's made a terrible mistake, and he's trying to right that wrong, and it puts him in a position where he's actually working against Mr. Robot, which is this other version of himself.
And I'm already lost just listening to you talk about it. There are a lot of layers of conspiracy here. And I think, you know, I tried to get into this show in the first season and I watched several episodes. It's really well done, but it is kind of complicated and hard to stick with. I left it halfway through the first season.
I think that's the problem with some of these really complex shows. I compare this show to Orphan Black, although I think Mr. Robot is a much better show and has kept its quality longer than Orphan Black has. And the third season is better than the second season for people who may have dropped off in the second season. But if you haven't seen those seasons or if you're fuzzy on the details, then when you're watching the show, there's almost a sense that they're talking about something that you know it's significant, but you don't know why it's significant. And so what happens with some of these shows is their viewership starts to drop as, you know, people become less invested in that, making that kind of effort to understand what's going on, even though the show itself is great and people who hang in there, you know, get to see an amazing story well told.
Okay, I want to ask you about another show that debuted this week on Hulu. This is Sarah Silverman's new show, I Love You, America. She did some singing in the series opener. Let's listen.
I love you, America, from sea to shining sea, from the East Coast to the West, and whatever's in between.
So what's this show about, and what's your take so far?
That's a good question. After watching the first episode, I'm still not sure. Basically, Sarah Silverman, the pitch for this show was that it was going to be Sarah Silverman putting herself in situations that she's not normally in, talking to people sort of outside the Hollywood bubble, outside of L.A. or New York. There wasn't a whole lot, frankly, of the show devoted to that. There was one pre-tape sequence where she visited a family in Louisiana that she said had never had dinner with a Jew. So she decided to go. But one of the things I find, for example, about these kinds of shows that try to break down barriers and talk to people is that they're hosted by people who haven't really studied how this works. And so, you know, as much as she tried to establish a dialogue, it wound up making the family look like they didn't have knowledge of the issues, and maybe that was why they voted for Trump. And so it didn't really break down walls in the way that the show promised. And there were other parts of the show that were kind of confusing. I didn't particularly find it all that entertaining. There was a better show, actually, that debuted on Thursday night called The Rundown with Robin Thede. And so this is a black woman hosting a late night show that's focused on minority issues and talking about issues from a black perspective. Really funny. And I've always been impressed with her. So it's good to see her get a chance to host a great late night show.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks as always.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Houston, the Florida Keys, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Las Vegas, and Northern California. There's been so much pain across the U.S., it's easy to overlook the news outside our borders. For instance, Israel proposed building thousands of new homes and settlements in the West Bank, while Egypt brokered a deal in which Fatah and Hamas, two clashing Palestinian groups, will form a unity government in Gaza. A high court in Italy said a man should get a softer sentence for murdering his son because his son was adopted. Imagine that. And Spain is demanding of Catalonia, are you seceding or not? But wait, there's a lot more. So we decided to do an international news we're not paying attention to roundup with Will Dobson, NPR's chief international editor. Hi, Will.
Hi, Robin.
Thank you so much for coming in to remind us of stories like the one you want to start with, Kenya. The opposition leader there, Raila Odinga, announced this week he'd pull out of the upcoming election because he doesn't expect it to be free and fair. This is after the Supreme Court there said a new election had to be held because of irregularities in the first. So give us the latest.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Kenya is really in uncharted waters here. That first election back in August, on August 8th, the Supreme Court nullified that election because of voting irregularities, and they ordered a rerun, which is supposed to take place on October 26th. And that in itself was actually a fairly incredible thing for an African court to nullify an incumbent election outcome. I mean, that in itself was, unprecedented. And now to have this week on Tuesday, the opposition leader say that he's pulling out because enough hasn't been done was completely unexpected and has really thrown everything off balance. Mm-hmm. So at this point in time, the government has said they're going ahead with the election. They've opened it up now to all the other candidates. And yesterday, on Thursday, announced that they were banning demonstrations, which is an important point because the opposition has been holding weekly demonstrations in the lead up. And so you have a very combustible situation, and people are on edge.
Okay, so we'll keep an eye there. Turkey, diplomatic tensions with the U.S. are at an all-time high after Turkey imprisoned several Americans, including employees of the U.S. consulate. Now Turkey's president Erdogan says he won't recognize the U.S. ambassador. Remind us how we got to this point and what's the sense of where we go here?
Well, the U.S.-Turkey alliance is definitely under strain, and it's been increasingly so. In this particular case, and this really kicked off on Sunday, the U.S. stopped issuing non-immigrant visas in Turkey after Turkish authorities arrested a U.S. employee, a Turkish national, at the U.S. consulate in Istanbul. So Turkey has responded by doing the same. And so now you have these two allies, really been critical allies along key issues like the fight against ISIS and elsewhere, that are essentially sort of frozen traffic between the two countries, which is we're talking about enormous numbers. I mean, about 500,000 Americans visit Turkey every year. This could affect 100,000 Turks coming to the U.S. And so both sides are trying to find a way to de-escalate this.
Okay, so we're going to keep an eye on that. And finally, many Americans, I don't think, know that the U.S. said it will pull out of UNESCO. This is the U.N.'s cultural organization that designates the World Heritage Sites, many of which we're seeing destroyed in places like Syria. And the U.S. cited anti-Israel bias at UNESCO.
Right.
What's going on here?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a real, I'm glad you're bringing it up because this is a really easy one to have missed this week. So the UNESCO, as you said, it handles World Heritage Sites. It also does a lot else in terms of scientific initiatives, literacy projects, gender equality issues. And this, for some time, there's been concern from the United States about, and expressions from Ambassador Nikki Haley that there is an anti-Israel bias from UNESCO. And in particular, this what really was for, I think, people in the administration a breaking point was this summer when it designated the old city of Hebron in the West Bank as a Palestinian World Heritage Site. This was denounced really across the board in Israel and was of concern to the U.S. And so that plus the State Department's announcement in this said that plus their mounting arrears was made the U.S. say that now it's time to pull out. Now, since 2011, the United States has not been funding UNESCO, and there's been an on and off relationship. But critics of the administration will say this is less about having any sort of bias and more sort of emblematic of the Trump administration's ambivalence towards the international community and the UN in particular.
Well, and Israel says they're also leaving, so two members of UNESCO suddenly departing.
That's right.
NPR's chief international editor, Will Dobson. Will, thank you so much for reminding us of the very many things going on in the world. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.